yard when the jacaranda tree was in full purple bloom. They didn't have the slightest inkling of how to look after a baby. They made it up as they went along and played with her, like two children with a doll. Thousands of cups of tea. Thousands of conversations about what to eat and what to wear and how to get there. Thousands of shopping trips. Thousands of circuits of the island. Running when they were children. Strolling languidly when they were teenagers. Power walking with hand weights when they were middle-aged and worried about cholesterol and osteoporosis. And then slower and benter. And even slower, until they bought their hotted-up bikes, the best thing they ever did, and once again they were children again, with the air skimming their cheeks as they soared around the new unfurling sandstone footpaths that always reminded Rose of the yellow brick road in The Wizard of Oz. I didn't properly appreciate one damned moment. Someone starts a CD, and music begins to play. What a Wonderful World, by Louis Armstrong. It must be Connie's choice. According to Margie, Connie has specified every tiny detail for her funeral. Rose didn't even know she liked this song. People turn their heads towards the back of the church, keeping their faces blank, reminding themselves that they're here to see a coffin, not a bride. Rose twists slightly in her seat, and her back shrieks in pain. There's no surprise about Connie's choice of pallbearers, Jimmy's four nephews who used to come and stay on the island for school holidays. The boys are men in their 50s now, but to Rose, as she watches them walk down the aisle, they don't seem all that different from the four little boys they were. None of them have lost their hair. They still have identical curly mops, like clowns. They were extremely naughty children, always breaking things. You had to watch them like hawks. As they walk down the aisle of the church, each with one shoulder hunched to carry the gleaming coffin, their heads solemnly bent, Rose realizes she is still carefully monitoring their behavior, as if at any moment they'll let the coffin crash to the ground and go pelting off to play with their water pistols. Connie was always very good with the boys, whereas Rose felt a bit scared of them and tried to cover it up by acting too strict and schoolmarmish. Connie cooked them enormous meals, and she and Jimmy had midnight water fights with them, whooping around the island in the moonlight. It should be Connie's own sons carrying the coffin, not Jimmy's sister's children. Jimmy should have let her adopt. He'd let her do anything else she wanted. Rose feels a fresh surge of anger, as if it had all happened yesterday. She should have spoken up after the war, when it became clear that Jimmy and Connie would not be contributing to the baby boom. She should have said, "Don't be so stubborn, Jimmy. It doesn't suit you. Pick something else to be stubborn about if you must prove yourself a man, but let her adopt a baby, for heaven's sake." People thought bringing up Enigma gave Connie all the mothering she needed. Rose was the only one who knew why Enigma wasn't enough. Rose was the only one who knew, without ever talking about it, how much Connie yearned for her own babies. The problem was that Jimmy got in a bad mood when he learned the truth about Alice and Jack. That was his ace, and he played it. Connie should never have told him. It offended his pride, made him feel silly. "You women have all been sniggering behind my back," he kept saying. The coffin passes, and Rose looks at her lap. Next to her, Enigma is sobbing with abandon into a man's handkerchief. Ever since she was a baby, Enigma has cried when she's unhappy and laughed when she's happy. For a person whose whole life is built on a mystery, she's very unmysterious. There is nothing enigmatic about Enigma. The boys lower the coffin onto its pedestal and walk back down the aisle, separating to go to their wives and children. Rose tries to smile at them, but they have their heads bowed. Another song starts. Danny boy. Oh, Connie, really? Sly old thing. Rose can just imagine her chuckling as she threw that one in. This will get the waterworks going. Enigma is now howling like a two-year-old, like the two-year-old she was. Margie is making soothing sounds, like the two-year-old she was. Margie was born motherly. Rose carefully shifts again to see which members of the funeral club have turned up, and their expert reaction to Danny Boy. Good Lord. The first person she sees is Mick Drummond, with his ancient bobbing head. Would that man never die? Was he immortal? Was he real? Would he outlive them all? He'd been old for decades, it seemed. Wait until she tells Connie. She turns back around and sees the coffin again, lustrous black, like a grand piano. It hits her with a horrible lurch that she won't be eating cinnamon toast tonight at Connie's kitchen table and telling her all about her own funeral. It is pointless saving up the good bits. Rose's big sister is lying flat on her back in her good burgundy suit inside that shiny box, with her face collapsed and her lipstick perfect, but somehow not quite right. I'm the only one left in the Doughty family, thinks Rose. You've all abandoned me. She wants to wail and sob and stamp her feet. She is 5 years old and stuck in a dreadful old woman's body that aches and creaks. Mum, Dad, Connie, how could you just leave me here all alone? It's not right. I'm the youngest. I shouldn't be left here on my own. Chapter 21. We are here today to celebrate the life of Connie Thrum. The priest stands behind the pulpit with hands outspread. He is a fresh-faced boy. No surprises there. Children are running the dashed world, thinks Enigma, while tears slide down either side of her nose, trailing pink rivulets through her face powder. Doctors, policemen, politicians, newsreaders. Children everywhere, acting so important. They think they've always been in charge, which is sweet, although sometimes inconvenient, such as when the doctor refuses to give Enigma the prescription she requests and tries to come up with her own ideas, when Enigma knows exactly what it is that she needs. They all take themselves so damned seriously. Sometimes Enigma has to try not to laugh. All this talk about Australia's aging population, when anybody with eyes can see it's not aging, it's younging, or whatever the opposite word to aging is. Connie would know the right word. Connie filled in every single square of the Sydney Morning Herald cryptic crossword puzzle every single day. The clues are all nonsense to Enigma. Connie was always a real smart woman. Enigma remembers the night they all sat around doing the national IQ test on television, and Connie got the highest score. Ron had been furious and made accusations of cheating, pretending he was being funny, but everyone could see right through him. Veronica had accused her father of being a misogynist, and Thomas had told Veronica to stop acting like a pseudo-lesbian intellectual. Enigma didn't understand either accusation. Rose had dreamily refused to take part in the IQ test. Luckily, Thomas got quite a high score, nearly as high as Connie, which was a relief because ever since Enigma dropped him when he was a baby, she has been secretly observing him for signs of brain damage. Nobody knows about this. She has never told a soul. It wasn't her fault. He was such a slithery baby. Even when Thomas went on to study at the university, she never completely relaxed, worrying that perhaps he was some kind of idiot savant. Enigma leans back and peeks a look down the aisle at Thomas, sitting next to his wife, dull as dishwater Deborah, with dear little Lily on her lap. Oh dear, Thomas looks quite stupid today with his mouth hanging open like that. He probably does have a touch of brain damage. Certainly it was stupid of him not to hold on to Sophie Honeywell, who was so funny and pretty and really enjoyed her food. Rose hasn't cried at all, Enigma notices. She is sitting very still, looking at the priest with that gracious, blank expression she gets. You can never tell what she's thinking. That Rose is an odd fish, all right, Enigma's husband Nathaniel used to say. Connie played many roles in her life, says the boy priest. She was an outstanding member of the community, a successful businesswoman, a loving sister to Rose, loving wife to Jimmy, and loving adoptive mother to Enigma. Yes, well, excuse me, that's not strictly true. She never actually adopted me. Enigma remembers coming home from school one day and asking Connie if she could call her mum. No, you can't, Connie had said. One day when you're 40 years old, I'll explain why. This is nothing to cry about, Enigma. Save your tears for something worthwhile. Enigma had still cried. She didn't need to save them up. Her tear ducts had never let her down. When the other kids teased her for being the Alice and Jack baby and having a funny name, she would plonk herself on the ground, bury her face in her hands, and bawl luxuriously until they got bored with yelling things like, "Your dad stabbed your mum in the guts," and "Enigma's mum was a murderer." She liked being the Alice and Jack baby. It made her feel special and exotic, like a girl in a film. And she loved a good cry. Afterwards, she always felt serene and slightly sleepy. Once, she revealed this to her granddaughter, Veronica, who told her that when you cry, your body releases a chemical like a sedative. "You're probably addicted to that sedative, Grandma Enigma," Veronica had said. "You're like a druggie." A druggie? That child talks such rubbish at times. Margie should have smacked her more when she was little. Enigma leans forward to see Veronica sitting at the end of the pew, her skinny face all twisted in a ferocious expression. She'll give herself wrinkles, probably still sulking over Connie leaving her house to Sophie. It is a pokey, old-fashioned house anyway, difficult to clean. Enigma doesn't know why Veronica is making a fuss over it. Such a pity that Veronica's marriage to Jonas had been a flop. But then Jonas had been a wishy-washy sort of fellow. No match for Veronica. She needed a good, firm man in her life. Actually, what that child needs, thinks Enigma, sniffing noisily, is a real good fuck. She sits back in her seat with a satisfied nod and rummages through her bag to find her Tic Tacs. She enjoys thinking deliciously shocking thoughts from time to time. It does her good. How many calories in a Tic Tac? Wonders Margie, as her mother rattles the little plastic box in her face. Surely not many. Perhaps none at all. She holds out her hand and Enigma tips a white lolly into her palm. Margie puts it in her mouth, sucks, and immediately begins to viciously attack herself. "This is why you're so fat, you blubbery whale," you greedy pig. Calories are insidious. Why do you say yes every single time food is offered to you? Why are you so weak? Why are you so pathetic? Can't you feel how the waistband of your skirt is digging into your pasty, doughy flesh? And you don't even like Tic Tacs. She remembers a tip she learned at the last Weight Watchers meeting. If you don't love it, don't eat it. Surreptitiously pretending to cough, she is about to spit the Tic Tac into her hand when her mother suddenly shoves against her arm as she leans across her to offer the Tic Tacs to Ron. This causes Margie to gulp and swallow the Tic Tac and all the calories it contains without even tasting it. It's probably one of those deadly, calorie-packed food items, like cashew nuts. They have been warned to avoid cashew nuts. Margie gives her mother a reproachful look, which Enigma doesn't notice at all. Tic-tac, Ron! She is hissing. For heaven's sake, surely it's disrespectful to be passing Tic-tacs down the pew during a funeral. The priest is trying to talk. A minute ago, her mother had been crying her eyes out into one of Dad's old hankies, and now here she is cheerfully handing out Tic Tacs. Margie has always secretly suspected that her mother is just a bit shallow. Ron takes a Tic Tac, of course, just to amuse himself, and offers, by raising his eyebrows and inclining his head, to pass the Tic Tacs down the aisle to other members of the family. He is doing it to make fun of Enigma, and she doesn't even know. He thinks he's superior to everyone. Has he always been like this? Margie can't remember. And I know Connie's wonderful blueberry muffins will be sadly missed. The priest gives them a gentle, sad twinkle, and there is a ripple of fond laughter. Margie, who told the priest to say that, chuckles along with them. My thighs certainly won't miss them, she thinks. At least with Aunt Connie dead, there won't be so much fattening, calorie-laden food on the island. No more Connie turning up with a freshly baked caramel fig loaf or a tray of honey cakes, even though she knew perfectly well that Margie was trying to lose weight. What a selfish, fat person thing to think. She loved Aunt Connie, although she did always feel a bit relieved when Connie left the room. She'd noticed that whenever Connie left, she could feel herself exhaling, just slightly, as if she'd been holding her breath. Connie could make her feel slow and bovine, the way she'd suddenly snap her head around and bark a question that would leave Margie fumbling for an answer. Even if it was a perfectly ordinary question like, "How are you, Margie?" It sounded like a test. Connie always seemed disappointed with her answers, as if she'd expected more, although Margie never knew in what way. She'd certainly never shown the slightest sympathy for Margie's attempts to lose weight. "You're too old for such rubbish! Of course you want a second piece." Connie was very skinny. The waistband of Margie's skirt is cutting cruelly into her waist. It's a wonder Connie hadn't specified what everyone should wear to the funeral. Her list of instructions had been so meticulous, leaving nothing to chance. There was even a running sheet for the service. Margie is quite convinced that Connie just decided to die that night. She can imagine her thinking to herself, "Right, that's it. Time to go." For the last 3 days, Margie has had Connie's voice in her head. No sickly sweet speeches. No flowers. Heat spinach and ricotta triangles at 300 degrees for 15 minutes. Do not microwave. They go soggy. It has been tiring organizing this funeral, along with all her normal work. Margie would quite like to curl up in a corner somewhere and go to sleep. She wishes her mother, or her daughter, had asked if she'd needed a hand. She would have said no thank you, of course, but still, just for the recognition. Everybody likes a pat on the back, as they say. Ron seems quite convinced. She sits around all day watching television. With Connie gone, she'll have a bit more time to herself. That's horribly disloyal to think, but it's true. People were always going on about how remarkable it was that both Connie and Rose managed to look after themselves at their ages. Tough old biddies, they'd say admiringly. It's true that Connie and Rose were remarkable for their ages, and Margie was so proud of them. Their minds were as sharp as tacks. But a fair amount of behind-the-scenes work had gone into ensuring they thought that they'd been managing just as well as they had 10 years ago. Not that she begrudged the extra washing or ironing or cleaning or shopping. "Don't do so much for them," her sister Laura was always saying. "Then they might realize they need to go into a retirement home." "They'll go into a retirement home over my dead body," Margie had retorted. "It probably will be your dead body," Laura had told her very unsympathetically, before she jetted off to Europe, leaving her daughter with a brand new baby. Fancy deliberately choosing to take yourself to the other side of the world when your first grandchild was about to be born. Still, each to their own, as they say. Next to her, Ron shifts slightly and sighs. She can smell the contemptuously classy smell of the aftershave he buys at the airport when he travels away on business. His legs next to hers, encased in newly dry-cleaned Armani suit trousers, with sharp, straight creases down the centre, are masculine and controlled. Margie is nothing but soft, oozing, spreading thighs and breasts and bottom. "I'll show all of you," thinks Margie with sudden determination. "I'll lose weight. I'll lose kilo after kilo after kilo, and then I'll emerge from all this flesh, skinny and hard and light and free." The priest seems to think he is a fucking talk show host. Ron looks at his watch. He has a meeting in the city at 2. Margie promised him the service would go for no more than an hour, but Margie just says whatever it is she thinks you want to hear, with no particular regard for the facts. If this goes on for much longer, he'll just get up and walk out. For some reason, his eyes keep returning to that shiny, expensive-looking coffin. He wonders how much it cost, and considers leaning over to ask Margie just to see her panicky mortification. He doesn't know much about the funeral industry, but he suspects the margins are excellent. "So you cucked it, Connie." He feels a flicker of triumph, as if he has won something. He does not bother to analyze this feeling. He's not into navel-gazing. Ding dong, the witch is dead. He did respect the old bird. She never fussed. Generally, women waste a lot of time fussing. Fuss, fuss, chat, chat. Never get to the point. Whereas Connie said exactly what she meant. When he'd first met her, over 30 years ago now, she could throw a frisbee like no woman he'd ever seen. A good straight pass that sliced the air. Margie always did these feeble, pathetic tosses as if her arm was made of plasticine. Back then, he thought that was cute. Back then, he was thinking with his dick. Yes, Ron had always respected Connie, even though he suspected the feeling was not mutual. That doesn't concern him, especially. He doesn't need to be liked. A lot of people don't like him. It's their problem, not his. Connie was a woman of strong Christian ideals, says the priest. What a load of crap. Connie was a hard-nosed manipulator who conned the whole bloody country. The island has lost its dictator. Now who will tell them all what to eat for fucking breakfast? Ron stops listening to the priest and lets his eyes glaze over. It doesn't bother him that Connie or any of the women have never once asked him for his advice about the business. He just finds it ironic. He is, after all, a business consultant. Quite a successful one. Executives with MBAs who are running multi-million-dollar corporations come to him for advice, but not the old women in his own family. It doesn't seem to have ever occurred to any of them, not even his wife. They ask him to open jar lids and change light globes. They don't ask him to look at their financial statements. In fact, he has never even seen the financial statements for Scribbly Gum Enterprises, although he has often idly attempted to calculate its net worth. As a shareholder, Margie would have access to the figures, but she has never asked for his help interpreting them. It wouldn't surprise him if she didn't even know the difference between a balance sheet and a profit and loss. They don't invest much, but then Connie and Rose have always been so careful with their money. It's a legacy of growing up during the Depression. Ron has an uncle who is incapable of putting more than a speck of butter on his toast. He would quite like to see the Scribbly Gum figures. He is ready to be impressed by the capabilities of a trio of old women. He is no misogynist, in spite of what his daughter Veronica might think. Thank Christ, the priest seems to have finally wrapped up the eulogy and is moving on to the procedural part of the day. Move it along, mate. A fast funeral is a good funeral. Ron is not completely sure what the word misogynist means. He keeps forgetting to look it up in the dictionary because he doesn't have a dictionary. Proof that he is not a misogynist is that when his son Thomas was growing up, Ron fully expected him to turn out to be gay, and he was fine with this. He would have said, no problem, mate. That's how open-minded he is. He's almost disappointed that Thomas ended up so bloody conventional. Look at him, sitting there holding hands with his bland, sexless wife. He should have held on to that Sophie. Now she was a sexy little thing. Someone is opening the double doors at the back of the church. Daylight spills in and people turn, disapproving and interested, to see who is so late. Speak of the devil. Here she is. Yes. Far too sexy for poor old Tom. Chapter 22. Grace turns around and sees Callum at the back of the church, holding the door for a girl with a wedge of honey brown hair falling over one eye. Even from this far away, she can see the girl's face is aflame with colour. Veronica, who is next to Grace holding the baby, makes a disgusted sound and mutters something under her breath, nostrils twitching and eyes darting like a mad person. It's that Sophie Honeywell, Grace realizes. She recognizes her from when she was bridesmaid at Veronica's wedding. She remembers now feeling charmed by some funny, self-deprecating story Sophie had told her about the stupid things the wedding photographer had made them do between the church and the reception. She'd pulled faces and mimicked the photographer. Sophie is obviously hoping for somewhere to sit at the back. She is desperately craning her neck while people stare comfortably back at her. Callum has seen that there is space at the end of the front pew next to Veronica and Grace. He makes an affable gesture for Sophie to go ahead of him, but she is all in a fluster. Callum places a hand on her shoulder, gently propelling her forward, and Sophie has no choice but to walk down the aisle. The priest stops talking and waits with elaborate priestly patience while everyone in the front row turns their legs sideways to let Callum and Sophie shuffle past.
"Incredible!"
hisses Veronica, bitterly shaking her head. She rocks the baby furiously and slides down towards the end of the pew. Callum sits down next to Grace. "Sorry I'm so late," he whispers, and puts his hand over hers. Sophie sits down on the other side of him and looks straight ahead, while Veronica makes an exaggerated show of squeezing even further away from her. The priest raises his hands again, and at that point, the baby begins to cry. Automatically, Callum turns and reaches across Sophie to take the baby from Veronica. Tenderly, expertly, he holds Jake over one shoulder, pats his bottom, and sways slightly in his seat. The baby stops crying immediately. Grace watches Sophie watching Callum and the baby. Sophie's eyes, which seem to be the same honey color as her hair, are lingering on them both, with the yearning, enchanted expression of a child standing in front of a magical Christmas display in a shopping center. Chapter 23. Scribbly Gum Island, 1999. It was 13 weeks since her husband's funeral. Connie Thrum stood at her stove, browning lamb shanks and rubbing her neck with her free hand. Jimmy used to stand behind her when she was cooking and rub her neck while he offered enthusiastic, exceedingly dumb suggestions. "How about a bit of parsley, Con?" It bugged her. She didn't need her neck rubbed when she was cooking, and she didn't like people watching her. She liked to present them with the completed meal, nicely arranged on a good quality plate, and see their eyes light up. "Scat!" she'd say to Jimmy. "Stop lurking! Can't you find something better to do?" Now, when she was cooking, she missed him rubbing her neck so much it gave her stomach cramps. Until he died, she hadn't realized just how often Jimmy had touched her. A kiss on the forehead in the morning when he brought in her morning tea. Sudden bear hugs if they met in the hallway. When they watched the 6 o'clock news together, they'd sit thigh to thigh on the sofa, and he'd absent-mindedly stroke her arm while he concentrated on the news, frowning heavily and muttering beneath his breath at the politician's lies. He'd run his fingers up and down her spine while they read together in bed, and patting her bottom. Well, the man couldn't leave it alone. "What's so fascinating about it?" she'd asked him once. "It was the first thing I noticed about you," he told her. "You're pretty bum." Really? He must have patted and pinched it a dozen times a day. She could never train him out of the habit. Sometimes he'd sneakily try to do it in public, which she found disgraceful and he found hilarious. The problem was that after all those years, her body seemed to have adapted to being touched. Now the touching had stopped, just like that, with no warning, and it was a shock, like a blast of cold air. Jimmy hadn't even been sick. They were going to do the fruit shopping one ordinary Thursday morning, and she walked into the kitchen, and there he was, lying on the floor, sending her heart flying into her throat. "What are you doing?" she shrieked out foolishly into the silence. The last thing he'd said to her, only seconds before, was, "I can't find my bloody wallet, Con." Now her untouched body felt like a plant drooping without water. Her skin was drying up and shriveling before her eyes, becoming astonishingly ugly, as if the touch of Jimmy's fingers had been keeping it alive. Lately she had been secretly stroking her neck when she cooked, patting her arm when she watched the news, wrapping her arms around herself when she went to sleep. Once, ridiculously, she even patted her own bottom. Still, it was better than crying so hard you felt like you couldn't breathe. She took the shanks out of the pan and began layering the base of her good oven pot with chopped-up onion, mint leaves and garlic. Lamb shanks with Guinness. Jimmy's favourite. She kept making his favourite dishes, as if that would make him feel closer, as if that would make up for the fact that the last words he'd heard from her were, "For heaven's sake, you'd lose your head if it wasn't screwed on." She'd noticed over the years of their marriage that they were always going through patches. Good ones, bad ones, so-so ones. For example, there was that really enjoyable time in the early 80s when they discovered apricot massage oil from Avon. Goodness me, that had certainly spiced things up in the bedroom. And once in the bathroom and quite a few times in the living room. But then, of course, there were the bad times, like after the war, when she told him the truth about Alice and Jack. He was furious. He got such a wounded look on his face. She never forgot it. And when he refused to see the doctor about why she wasn't getting pregnant. She'd hated him for a while over that. Really hated him. But then she just got tired of hating him and started loving him again. It was easier. And then, interspersed between the really good times and the really bad times, were the so-so times, where they didn't take all that much notice of each other, just ambled along, like a brother and sister, really. Maybe a bit snitchy at times. They were in the middle of a snitchy patch when he died. Perhaps the poor man hadn't been feeling well. Good Lord. She held onto the counter for balance. Sometimes the pain of missing him was so bad it almost knocked her off her feet. She poured stock and Guinness into the pot and bent, one hand on her back, to put it in the oven. It was the first time she'd hosted a dinner party since Jimmy died. There would be 10 people. Enigma, Rose, Margie, Ron, Thomas, Veronica, Laura, Callum, Grace, and... the guest. Oh, for heaven's sake, what was the fellow's name? She knew it perfectly well. She was good at remembering names. Jimmy was hopeless. When they went to parties, someone would catch sight of Jimmy and their face would break into a grin because everyone loved him. And Connie would lean over, barely moving her lips like a ventriloquist. Paul Bryson, tennis, local council. And Jimmy wouldn't even blink. He'd cry, "Paul, mate, how's that killer serve of yours?" Now for the sticky caramelized apples. Thomas's favourite dessert. Poor old Thomas, according to Margie, was eating nothing but rice crackers. He was so distraught over the Sophie business. Sophie had broken it off 2 weeks ago, just before he was going to take her to Fiji, of all the ridiculous places, to propose. What was wrong with right here on Scribbly Gum Island? The family was up in arms about it. They were probably more upset about Sophie's defection than Jimmy's death. The fact was that Connie was actually upset about the Sophie business too. She'd been quite taken with her the few times she'd met her. Not that she'd met her that often. It was like pulling teeth getting Thomas to come to the island these days. But she'd come to the house for afternoon tea a month or so after Jimmy had died, and Connie had felt marginally better just looking at her. It was those dimples, a thumbprint on either side of her mouth. The dimples were still there, even when she wasn't smiling. Her enthusiasm for the house and Scribbly Gum Island had reminded Connie of Jimmy, the way he was that first day he rowed her out to the island, his cinnamon eyes all shiny. For years, before she packed away those dreams forever, Connie had imagined hers and Jimmy's child. She'd always thought they'd have a son, a miniature version of Jimmy. But when Connie looked at Sophie, she found herself imagining what it would have been like to have had a daughter. It was strange, feeling that old pain for a child, like hearing the notes of an old song. When Sophie had seen Jimmy's boots still sitting there on the back veranda, she'd stopped, put her hand on Connie's arm and said, "You must miss your husband so much." Not in a sappy, sentimental way. No. She looked genuinely sympathetic. "Yes, I do," Connie had said, and had had to suppress a tremor in her voice. "Yes, I do." Everyone in Connie's family seemed to expect her to just get on with it, as if the death of your husband was to be expected. 5 days after Jimmy died, Enigma actually had the hide to say, "What a grumpy face you have today, Connie." "Grumpy?" But Sophie said, "You must miss your husband so much." Such a simple thing to say, and the girl was probably being polite, just well brought up. But for some reason, Connie had found it profoundly touching. How wonderful to have a daughter like that. Sophie wasn't right for Thomas, though. Connie could tell. He was too damned grateful to have her. A woman wants to be adored, but she doesn't want reverence. Thomas was trying too hard. He had the strained expression of a man who is underqualified for his job. He laughed too loudly at her jokes and sat too close to her. Sweet, serious, worried Thomas. He needed a woman who made him feel like a man, and Sophie needed a man who could give her a run for her money. He was just plain too wimpy for her. Still, it would have been nice to have had Sophie there at family events. She clearly loved the island. She might even have convinced Thomas to live there. She would have brightened up the place, like Jimmy did. Yes, Jimmy's daughter would have been just like Sophie, and maybe the island would have been a different place with her light-hearted touch. She was the missing ingredient they needed. The hint of nutmeg. Connie stirred brown sugar in melted butter and watched the sugar dissolve. Would 6 apples be enough? There had to be enough food, and it had to be perfect. If her standards slipped, Laura would be on her case about getting somebody in to help, or even suggesting she move off the island to a retirement village. She, Connie Thrum, in a retirement village filled with doddering geriatrics. It had been terrible the first time Connie washed sheets after Jimmy died, and she realized he wasn't there to pull them out of the machine for her and carry them out to the line. She'd leaned over, tugging uselessly at the wretched, heavy things, which had got all twisted around the rotor. And when she realized it was hopeless, she'd kicked the washing machine in futile rage and really hurt her foot. Then she'd found herself sitting on the laundry floor, sobbing like a baby. It just seemed so unfair and undignified that after all the hard work of her life, all the striving and the planning and the worrying, she would end up defeated by 2 wet sheets. She didn't know what she would have done if Margie hadn't turned up and made her a cup of tea and kept up a meaningless stream of comforting Margie babble while she lifted the sheets out of the washing machine and pegged them on the line for her. Now, whenever Margie came over, she quietly helped herself to a load of washing, even stripping the sheets off the bed and remaking it, and brought it back the next day, all neatly pressed and folded. It wasn't necessary, of course. Connie wasn't a helpless old woman. But still, bless her. Anyway, Connie could still damn well cook them all a bloody good meal. What was that extra fellow's name who was coming tonight? It was driving her batty trying to think of it. It was right there on the tip of her tongue. 2 hours later, she still hadn't remembered his name, and there he was, at the other end of the table, nodding politely as Veronica ranted away about something. Looking around at the self-absorbed faces of her family, Connie felt an overwhelming desire to send everybody home and eat cinnamon toast alone in front of the television. There was Ron, sitting in Jimmy's place with such a smarmy, self-satisfied expression on his face that Connie wanted to give him a good slap. Good Lord! He'd been a shy, gawky teenager when he first started courting Margie, and now look at him, sniping away at her. And there was Margie, pretending so hard to be happy when she'd been unhappy for years. It made Connie furious. The silly ninny was on some new diet where she ate nothing but protein. This apparently meant she couldn't eat Connie's roast potatoes. Don't be ridiculous, Connie snapped, and spooned out three for her. You've loved my roast potatoes since you were a little girl. Oh, Connie, said Margie reproachfully. Aunt Connie, you're sabotaging Mum's diet, cried out Veronica. Nobody actually force-feeds your mother, said Ron. She could just leave them on her plate. Nobody supports her either, said Veronica. I support her, said Laura. I keep inviting you to join my tennis club, Margie. Yes, well, I am thinking about it, said Margie uncertainly. I wouldn't bother Aunt Margie, said Grace. Mum's tennis friends spend more time worrying about their manicures than actually playing tennis. Grace's tone was light, but Connie noticed she didn't look at Laura as she spoke. It was Jimmy who had first pointed that out to Connie. Have you noticed that Grace never looks at her mother if she can help it? He'd said. There's something not right there. Something not right with my whole bloody family, thought Connie now. Well, the potatoes are delicious, Mrs. Thrum, contributed their guest. It seemed that everyone was determined to be as unhelpful as possible by not saying the fellow's name. Thank you, dear, said Connie. He had a nice, kind look about him, that boy. My friend Janet rang today, announced Enigma. I'm very upset about it. Here we go, muttered Laura, picking up her wine glass. She's going to become a great-grandmother for the second time, and she's younger than me, said Enigma. The only news I had to tell her was that my grandson had just broken up with his fiancée. Thomas, all pale and hunched over his dinner plate, said, Sophie wasn't my fiancée, Grandma. I hadn't asked her yet. You had the ring. I saw the ring. It makes me cry to think about it. Enigma gave the table a watery, martyred smile. It's not Thomas's fault, Grandma Enigma, said Veronica. Sophie dumped him. I never saw it coming. Thomas gave a morose shake of his head. Never saw it coming. I thought she felt the same way. Of course you did, said Veronica. You'll meet someone else, darling. Margie had polished off all her potatoes. Miss Wright is waiting just around the corner. She might not be, you know, said Enigma darkly. June's grandson is 40 and can't find a woman to marry him. He has to live with another man. Two sad bachelors. Two gay bachelors, I'd say, said Laura, while Ron smirked. Grace, bless her, changed the subject by telling Enigma that Callum's mother was dying to meet her. She had a book of unsolved mysteries when she was young, explained Callum, and the Munro baby mystery was one of her favourites. It would be a pleasure to meet your mother, dear, said Enigma graciously. You can take her home an autographed photo of me if she'd like. Connie asked Callum, what were some of your mother's other favourite mysteries? Well, she does love a good grisly murder, my mum. She used to talk about the pyjama girl mystery, and, what was it? The breadboard murder. She was a young girl when they both happened.
I've never heard of either of them, said Grace.
Connie said, the pajama girl was a woman found in her pajamas near Albury in the 1930s. It was a horrible, brutal murder, and they couldn't identify who she was for 10 years. They kept her body preserved in a bath filled with formalin for all that time. The breadboard murder was a man who was found sitting at his kitchen table with his face in his breakfast. He'd been hit over the head once with a breadboard.
Oh, but they were just normal, run-of-the-mill murders, said Enigma dismissively. Not as interesting as our mystery. And they solved the Pajama Girl mystery.
Yes, but there was a big cover-up. I read a book about it, and it looks like they got the wrong man, said Veronica, who always seemed to know everything about everything. It was a wonder the child hadn't solved the Munro baby mystery for herself.
I bet the wife did the breadboard murder, said Laura caustically. He probably complained about his eggs, and she thought, that's it. I've had enough.
Yes, well, with that sort of attitude, it's no wonder your husband ran off with his dental nurse, thought Connie.
What's your favourite unsolved mystery, dear? Asked Margie, bringing the visitor back into the conversation.
Well, that's easy. The pyramids. I went to Egypt last year and they were extraordinary.
But Enigma had no interest in mysteries other than the one involving her. She sighed.
I was just thinking, you know, Sophie would have been such a pretty bride.
Mum, please. Margie made exaggerated gestures at her son, but Thomas, Connie could see, was in the mood for wallowing.
Well, she certainly would have been a blushing bride, said Veronica. Connie said, don't be spiteful.
I'm being factual, not spiteful, said Veronica.
Rudely, thought Connie, and turned enthusiastically to the visitor.
Sophie has a blushing disease. You've never seen anybody go so red. The first time I saw her do it, I couldn't believe it.
It's not a disease, said Thomas. It's a condition.
Whatever, said Veronica.
Is she very shy?
The visitor probably thought they were all mad, but he was certainly doing an excellent job of acting interested.
Oh, no, contributed Margie. That's what's so funny about her. She's very social.
Everyone loves her, said Veronica. She's manipulative.
For heaven's sake, is anybody else tired of the Sophie topic? Asked Laura.
I don't know, sighed Thomas. Maybe she was out of my league.
Oh, bullshit, said Veronica, causing Rose to flinch as she came back to the table.
Certain words didn't agree with her.
She's just average looking. It's not like she's as good looking as Grace, for example.
Veronica?
Grace dipped her head, while Callum beamed.
I thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world, said Thomas.
He turned to the visitor. Do you want to see a photo of her?
Sure, said the poor fellow, with what seemed to be genuine interest. He had such beautiful manners.
Thomas pulled his wallet out from his jeans, flipped it open, and reverently handed the picture over.
Oh, she's very attractive, said the visitor immediately.
At that point, Thomas put his elbows on the table, buried his head in his hands, and began to make strange, wheezy, gasping sounds.
Oh, for Christ's sake, said Ron.
Let it all out, darling, said Margie.
Maybe not at the dinner table, said Laura. We should sue Sophie for emotional distress, spat Veronica.
Why don't you ask her to marry you again? Said Enigma.
Maybe it's worth a second shot. Take along some marzipan tart. And did you mention to her that we're quite wealthy?
Connie was the only one to notice that the visitor had quietly taken the opportunity to slide the photo back across the table and steal a second look.
Did you see that, Jimmy?
I think our Sophie has an admirer.
Chapter 24. It is a misty grey Sunday afternoon, and Sophie is driving down the freeway towards Brooklyn, practicing not blushing. On the car seat next to her is a freshly baked coffee and walnut liqueur cake in a Tupperware container, and a bottle of expensive Sauvignon Blanc in a brown paper bag. Sophie is going to lunch with Grace and Callum on Scribbly Gum Island, and she hasn't felt this nervous about a social event since, well, since Aunt Connie's funeral the week before. And it isn't as though she can comfort herself with the thought that Aunt Connie's funeral hadn't turned out to be that bad after all. It turned out to be far worse than her worst imaginings. First of all, there was the humiliating incident in the taxi when she decided that Grace's husband was the father of her future children. Sophie makes pitiful ouch sounds each time she remembers it. She tells herself again and again that there is no need to feel embarrassed. It's not as if she threw her arms around him crying, "My love, at last I've found you." So she imagined some non-existent chemistry. So what? Big deal. Happens to everyone. It is extremely unlikely he somehow guessed she was checking her watch so she could tell their future children exactly what time it was when they met. She reminds herself that everyone has thoughts they wouldn't care to share with the world. Many people have quite perverse thoughts about doing things with animals or fruit or being spanked by nurses. The difference, of course, is that their thoughts are securely locked away behind bland faces, whereas Sophie's are always in danger of being revealed to all in a sudden flood of colour. Generally, she's quite resigned to her blushing. If minor disabilities were being distributed, she would, for example, still choose blushing over a horrendous facial twitch like her old school friend Eddie Ripple had suffered. Blushing is just her thing. It's like having an extraordinary sneeze. "I'm sorry I look like a tomato," she says to people. "Don't worry. It's not contagious." But she does not want a situation to develop where she blushes each time she sees a particular person, such as Callum Tidyman. If she blushes every time she sees him, people will most definitely notice and start to comment and assume she has a sweet little crush on him. It will ruin everything. She'll feel sick each time she walks outdoors. The last time something like this happened was when she was 15 and developed an automatic blush every time she saw the man who lived two doors down. Mr. Fisk had a large moustache, a wife, and three small children. He was not at all attractive. It was just that one day, when there was a neighbourhood barbecue, Sophie was appalled to find herself eating her sausage sandwich and imagining what it would be like to have sexual intercourse with Mr. Fisk. Mr. Fisk's dick. Mr. Fisk's moustache scraping against her upper lip. Naturally, it made her blush. And after that, just like Pavlov's dog salivating when the bell rang for dinner, Sophie blushed whenever she saw Mr. Fisk mowing the lawn or washing his car or talking to her dad about the cricket. It was a tremendous relief when the Fisk family moved to Adelaide. So this lunch is her opportunity to put a stop to any such neurotic behaviour with Callum. She will develop a friendship with both Callum and Grace, just like Aunt Connie had asked in her letter. Sophie is excellent at making new friends. She is quietly proud of this skill. If she can just get through those first few moments blush-free, she will be fine. Of course,
The problem with Callum might be the very least of her worries, because Sophie isn't quite sure of the purpose of this lunch. There's something a bit odd about it. After Aunt Connie's funeral was over, all she could think about was getting away as fast as possible. She couldn't believe that she had ended up being late and having to make such a public entrance, and then, horror of horrors, sitting in the front row with the family and next to Veronica, of all people, who had twitched and muttered for the next half hour like someone with Tourette syndrome. Directly behind her was Thomas, with his wife Debbie and baby Lily on her lap. Sophie could feel Debbie's eyes drilling triumphantly into the back of her neck, as if they had been involved in a competition for Thomas, and Debbie had won. At one point, Lily had reached forward and grabbed a handful of Sophie's hair. "Sorry," Debbie had whispered, sounding not at all sorry as she dislodged Lily's pudgy hand. Had she somehow trained her baby to pull Daddy's ex-girlfriend's hair? After the funeral had finally ended, she had talked to Enigma and Aunt Rose on the church steps, who had asked if she was coming to the afternoon tea. "We haven't seen you in so long," said Enigma. Sophie had seen Veronica's grandmother crying during the funeral, but now she seemed quite cheerful, reapplying bright red lipstick as she spoke. "We've missed you. You must come back with us." "I'm actually going to have to get back to work now," apologized Sophie. "You mustn't worry about Veronica, if that's what you're thinking," Enigma said. "She's just sulking. She'll get over it. She wasn't smacked enough when she was a child." "Were you smacked? I'm a great believer in smacking." "Oh, all the time," lied Sophie. In fact, her mother had never even so much as raised her voice at her without later buying her a special treat to make up for it. "You're very welcome to come along, dear," said Rose. "Connie would..." "Yes, Connie..." Her voice drifted off, and she seemed to forget she was speaking, her pale eyes looking dreamily past Sophie as she leaned heavily on her walking frame, the turquoise of her dress glimmering richly in the sun. She was like an aging fairy princess. "I love the color of your dress," commented Sophie. Rose had always been her favorite of the three old ladies. Rose blinked and caressed the fabric. "Yes. It's beautiful, isn't it? The fabric is quite good quality, too. This is my favorite color. Once I... well..." Rose looked around nervously, as if she'd forgotten her lines and was waiting for the prompt. "Ahem," said Enigma meaningfully. "Are we having an Alzheimer's moment, Rose, dear?" Sophie didn't know what they were talking about, but gave a surprised giggle, and Enigma chortled with her, looking proud. "I heard that on a television program. Alzheimer's moment. It's funny, isn't it? I say it all the time to my friends. Some